So, first of all, it's one of the reasons why people come to this center is to lessen their stress. And the stress levels of people these days get more and more and more, which is why a place like this becomes a wonderful resource for people. And there's two ways in which people can overcome their stress and their worry. And first of all is to come here and just feel some of the what you might call ambience of this place, and this welcome and kindness coming to a place where, you know, kids are very welcome to run around and they get used to the place. It's their home, which is wonderful, so they can relax. Elderly people can relax. And what was it some years ago where a person would come here and just that lady, or many years ago, where she came here and fell asleep, fast asleep, during the meditation, and started snoring and snoring and snoring. And she was welcome to snore. Only thing I had to tell somebody off, because they woke her up. Because she was a victim of quite gross, severe domestic abuse. And she came here and she felt safe in this room. A place where, you know, she could just relax, let things be. And for her, it was the case that she needed that safe place where she could just catch up on some sleep. And I thought it's wonderful that people can actually feel that. And even years ago in Bodhinyana Monastery, where the building inspector, who I would meet every now and again to submit plans, you know, for our buildings, but I never really got to know him, it was a him, until after many years he came up to see me personally to say thank you. And I wanted to know why he was saying thank you to me, and he said because whenever he got stressed out at work, all he would do was get in his car and come to the car park of Bodhinyana Monastery. And he said, thank you for your car park. Because even there, it was a place where he could feel accepted, relaxed. No one was going to go and talk to him and try and convert him or do any sort of really aggressive stuff like that. He just felt it was a peaceful place to be. And even over in Thailand, I remember one of the members here went over there. They were going into a temple somewhere. And sometimes people say, well, where can you find Buddhism in some of these temples in Bangkok when they're just so busy and so many sort of rituals and stuff? But he found Buddhism not actually inside the hall, but just outside of it. Because he saw this young lady, maybe in her 20s, and she was crying her eyes out. She was weeping. And being a guy, he thought, what should I do? Should I go and console her? Or is that culturally inappropriate? You know, what should I do? But he had some business inside the temple, so he went inside the temple first and did some business there, I don't know what it was, but came out after half an hour and saw the woman was not crying anymore. You know, she was still sitting on the seat. And so he thought, well, why not? He asked her, what was wrong? Is there anything I could do to help? And the woman said, no, it's okay now. I lost my car keys. And I sat down on here, on the seat, just to work it through, the emotion of, she didn't find her car keys. It was just that she was stressed out, upset, whatever it was. And all she needed was to get the ambience and the peace of the place. Not to be told what to do, but just to feel the peace and acceptance of a place. And so that's one of the things why, even to this place is, the monks aren't here or the nuns aren't here, there's nobody here, still you can always come to the car park. and just sit and be peaceful. And it just gives a sense of acceptance and happiness and joy, hopefully, and peace. So that you can feel just coming here. It relaxes you. Or you don't have to live up to anything. You don't have to achieve anything. You're not going to get criticized. You're not going to be harassed by somebody asking you to join up. We often say that all these talks, they have no, don't have to pay an entrance fee. But you do have to pay to get out. That's only a joke, by the way. But no, it's all for free. It's just letting people come in. And also, just a little bit of happiness every now and again. Because people do have some suffering in life. And I learned this when I was reminded of this story by one of our Thai followers. That when I was a young monk, we used to go over the for invitations here all over the place in Thailand in the back of a ute, a pickup truck. And I did actually go once on the back of a motorbike as a monk, never again on a motorbike. Because you know what happens? You can imagine these robes and a motorbike. Once they pick up any speed, the wind gets inside of them and it balloons up. And I was going to fly off because it's like a big balloon. But fortunately, I managed to hold on just. So never go on a motorbike with loose robes like this. But anyway, on the back of a truck, the old utes, they would have like a cover on it, a metal frame over which was draped a tarpaulin. And that was the place where you sit in the back with all the other monks going to this or that ceremony. And number one, it was really dusty. At least the tarpaulin would keep off any rain. And these were those days where the roads were all just dirt roads with lots of potholes. And in fact, because there was lots of potholes, that every time that truck, that ute, hit a pothole, what would happen was the ute went down and I would go up and hit my head on the metal frame. And that really hurt, especially because I've got no padding. So you hit your head really hard on this metal again and again and again. And I just, this was getting too much. It's really hurting. And I noticed that when any of the Thai monks or Laotian monks, whenever they cracked their head on one of these, the metal frame on which the tarpaulin was covered, when they hit their head, they never sort of grimaced. They never swore. They laughed. And they must have been hurting as much as I was, but they were laughing at the pain. And I thought, what's going on here? And because scientists before, so I used my science, my Western sort of logic, to actually think of explanations and theories why when Thai monks hit their head, they laughed. And my first theory was they must have hit their head so many times that they were brain damaged. But of course, that wasn't the case. Because they were really nice monks, they're very smart. And so then, I thought I couldn't understand. So what do? You do experiment. Now, Western culture, do an experiment, find out. So I resolved that the next time I hit my head, I was going to laugh instead of swear. I'd always swear in English because the Thai monks couldn't understand me, I thought, but they did. But anyway, when the next time I hit my head, I laughed. And I discovered an amazing theory. You should get the Nobel Prize for things like this because it's actually practical. That when you laugh when you hit your head, it hurts much less. And if you don't believe me, get the person sitting next to you. To hit you on the head. Better not do it here, I get in trouble with insurance. But you can see that just one's attitude towards sickness and pain changes many, many things. It does actually hurt much less when you laugh. So this was where I started to understand the relationship which we have with the stress of life. If you complain, you get more tight, more stress, and of course it hurts much more. And this is explained by that simile which I've been saying so often about the tight guitar string. It's so pulled at both ends that a small thing hits it. And of course you react. You overreact because you're so tense already. But if you're relaxed, the both ends of the guitar string are loose. At least as loose as you possibly can. Whatever happens to you makes hardly any sound at all. You've got what we call resilience because not stress. So laughing tends to relax you. So just having an ambience, a place where people aren't shouting at you and they aren't telling you to do this and to do that and making even more stress, that is very helpful in itself. So that woman who just sat outside the temple for half an hour, that released her stress enormously. I can know how that works. You don't even need to listen. You don't even need to be a Buddhist or be anybody. Just being here and relaxing to the max and know that you can do this. But of course, many people, when they come to these temples, they think, oh, what am I supposed to do? They're afraid of breaking some protocols. But the first protocol, the first rule, the first etiquette in any Buddhist monastery has to be kindness. Very good. Has to be compassion and learning how to make peace with things instead of fighting things. Out there in the world we fight and we fight and we fight. So, when I was meditating a few minutes ago, just, you know, the cough. I don't fight these things. I don't make war with them. I'm not afraid of them. If a cough comes, ha 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 ha, you laugh with it. You make peace with it. And then because you're relaxing your guitar string, for me, my vocal cords, you're really relaxing them. And relax, you feel them relax. Of course, then you don't tend to cough. The irritation is being dealt with in a very amazing, interesting way. So, these are little things we can learn how to deal with this stress, but you can get even deeper than that. To learn how to, in the office, if you've got someone in there in the workplace which, you know, gives you hell, you know, the boss from hell, and if you do have a boss from hell, how do you deal with that? You learn how to make peace with the boss from hell. Learn how to be kind. Now, I mention this, this is not just a theory. I know that somebody asked me just beforehand, can you sort of reading a Buddhist book about heavenly beings and devas? And I really thought, should I talk about devas today? I'll just talk about things which you don't have to believe in, but which you can know for your own experience. Of course you can know devas from your own experience, but that's a totally different thing. Here, the devas are like heavenly beings. Here it's your life right in this moment. You're stressed. Why? What can you do with it? So of course, if you try and fight, how can you make peace by having a war? People have tried that for so many times. The war which ends all wars. The aggression which will just put people in their place. Of course, it just makes more tightness, tension, more collateral damage. So instead, we have this beautiful way in Buddhism about making peace. The whole point is learning to change the relationship which you have with whatever you have to experience. Kids, that's what kids are like. I've never seen a kid who was really peaceful at that age. I don't know, you may have, I'm not sure. But, so what do I expect? The whole point of learning how to make peace is not learning how to change things and make people something they can never be. This is where we have this great, what's it called, the third noble truth of Buddhism, is that if you try and want this moment to be something different, if you think of something perfection, some shoulds, some ideals, some it shouldn't be this way, we should just not have allow any kids into the temple. We should not have any dogs in this temple. We should not allow Ajahn Brahm in this temple when he's contagious with a cough. We should have these machines I see in the airports where they actually just take your body temperature to make sure that you haven't got a disease. They should. But if we have all those shoulds, no one would probably be allowed into this temple. You're all wonderful human beings with many different faults and many different but every time you try and change those, to improve those, to make things different, that is called stress. Especially, maybe in your life you want to improve things. You may want to sort of clean up the garden, mulch everything, just wash all the dishes. Are you a perfectionist? If you are, you never find any peace. You'll just find stress because this world is never perfect. Even my saying years ago that never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. I love that saying because one day you are going to die. So why do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight? What about enjoying this moment today? If you go to the kitchen, you perfectionists, and you look and see how many dishes are dirty and need washing, how about looking how many clean dishes there are first? And if the clean ones outnumber the dirty ones, then quit while you're ahead. Why do I say that? Because one of the stories which I read many years ago, and I think I retold it in one of my first books, about the Japanese garden and the Zen master. Zen masters are usually really cool because they're totally almost off the planet in the way they do things. Totally, you can't understand them at first, but they tell a very good message. And this Japanese master, the young Japanese monk, was a gardener. And he made these amazing gardens. And his garden was one of the most famous in the whole of Japan. People would come from all over to admire just the balance of his garden. You just took one look at it and it was wow, really sort of was an amazing work of art. So this old monk, an old meditation monk, came early one morning, but the garden was closed. It was only supposed to be opened in the afternoon. But anyway, the old monk, he climbed over the railings and hid behind the bushes. He wanted to find out the secret of the most perfect garden in the whole of Japan. And he waited, and then the gardening monk came out. And he sat and meditated to prepare his mind just to get the clarity and the peace and the artistic balance in his own mind before he worked on the garden. And then he took these two big wicker baskets. In the middle of the garden was this very beautiful plum tree. And he went with those two baskets and picked up one by one every leaf or twig which had fallen the night before from the wind. And before putting them in the baskets, he would look at the little twig to see whether it had artistic merit. If it was the right shape or the right curvature, then he would put it in the good basket. If it was rubbish, he would put it in the rubbish basket. And the same with the leaves. Every leaf he picked up and examined it. And if he could make use of it, the right colour, the right shape, he'd put it in the good basket. And the others in the rotten basket. It took him hours to clean up the garden of all the leaves and twigs which had fallen the night before. A couple of hours. And then he stopped. He put the rubbish leaves on the compost and then he took tea. And after he took tea, he meditated for the most important part of the ceremony, of the making the beautiful garden. He took the basket of beautiful leaves and flowers, and not little twigs, and he placed them one, one by one in the garden, in exactly the right place, in exactly the correct orientation, so that they balanced and the interconnectivity of the leaves and the twigs and the colours. Sometimes he'd have to pause and correct. He looked at it, and he'd move a twig slightly. Yes, that's it. I don't know if you've ever seen great artists at work, but sometimes great artists at work, we think they're just being just too picky. But really great artists, they can see the big canvas of the garden and know exactly where things need to be, just slightly changed. And after another couple of hours, he was finished. And he admired his work. Most beautiful garden in the whole of Japan, he thought. And he was about to open the gate to let the visitors in. But then the old monk came out from behind the bush. And he said to the young gardening monk, said, I've been watching you all morning. And he said, your attention to detail is just so impressive. I've seen you just picking up all the bad leaves and the good leaves, separating them out and putting the good leaves. Look at that, that's amazing, Josh. Your artistic taste and talent is incredible. He said, your garden, said the old monk, is almost perfect. And at that word, almost, you can see the colour drain from that gardening monk's face. See his lips start to quiver. And he fell to his knees and he said to the old meditation monk, oh master, master, you've been sent by the Buddha himself to come and teach me how to make my garden even more perfect. Please instruct me. Please let your compassion flow. Please tell me your great wisdom. How can my garden be even more perfect? And the old monks, by the way, never trust an old monk. He asked the old monk. And the old monk said, do you really want me to show you? Yes, please, don't hold back your great skill and wisdom. So the old monk strode right into the middle of the garden, put his hands, he was old but still very strong, around the plum tree, and shook the hell out of it. Twigs, leaves fell all over the place, making a big mess of the garden. A whole morning's work destroyed. And that monk was so upset and angry, but imagine how he felt when the monk looked at his work with the garden a big mess and then said, Now, that is perfect. So what is perfection? What is no peace and lack of stress? Sometimes we spend so much time trying to make things just so, and we're going against the nature of the world. The nature of the world is a bit messy. Actually, sometimes quite messy. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try and tidy it up from time to time, but when you're aiming for perfection, you're just stressing yourself out way too much. So instead of looking at perfection as something out there, we learn how to make peace with things. To make peace when you swept the ground and a leaf falls on it, just where you swept. Ajahn Chah used to tell that story, I remember. He said, if you swept the path and a leaf falls on it, why does it stand out? It's because it's not entangled. It's not sort of confused with all the other leaves which have fallen down there. But if one leaf falls on there, you can really see it and get to know it and understand it. Because one of our problems in life is so complex, doing too many things, too many chores to be done, so we don't really understand just one thing, a simple thing, which is one of the reasons why hopefully you come to a place like this, and it is pretty simple. I don't know why people want to be complicated in life, because in simplicity, you can actually see things. It's not tangled up like a big forest where there's so many different plants all over the place. It's not entangled like when there's many, many ideas and theories. It's quite direct. Just make peace. Be kind. Understand how you are. And be at peace with that. And stop fighting the world. Stop fighting yourself. And as for the bosses in hell, I often say that, well, I suppose I'm a boss too. I run a monastery. Am I a boss from hell? You get in trouble when you get back to the monastery if you say I am. That's a boss from hell. And know that to learn how to be kind. And then what happens is people try and live up to your kindness. You're inspiring them. You're encouraging. You're leading the way through peacefulness rather than through fear. How many people just live through fear? You go to work afraid what the boss might say about you, may lose your job. Fear that, you know, you make a mess of things. Fear, again, is what causes that stress in our body, stress in our mind. The fear of people not liking you. The fear of making a big mistake. The fear, oh, it's wonderful if you can just somehow find a way out of fear. Fear that I might cough again. As soon as I said that fear, I wanted to cough. Have you ever noticed that what you're afraid of, what you fear, you tend to make happen? So, seeing that, sometimes instead of being afraid at life, afraid of this moment, afraid of people, afraid of what other people think of you, we see if we can find this wonderful kindness, acceptance, making peace with things, which actually is an antidote to fear. One of the things which I discovered by learning to give talks in public. This is nothing, giving a talk here just to a couple of hundred people, but sometimes imagine to 10,000 people. I think that's my record. 10,000 audience come especially just to see you. And I thought, oh my goodness, what if I mess up? what if all these people come all this way and I don't sort of satisfy them? What? I said, oh, shut up, Ajahn Brahm. And so I decided just to go out there, tell a few jokes, and and have fun. Like the latest joke, I told a few people this just before we came in here, that what's the coolest doctor in a hospital? The coolest doctor in a hospital is the hip doctor. He's hip. So I think that's funny. Other people don't, but that's how you overcome fear. Don't ever worry what other people think of you. And if you don't laugh at the joke, the least you laugh at your own joke. So anyway, back to learning how to overcome fear, which is not a form of tension. What might happen? And that fear of what might happen is, don't worry, but what we say, be hopey. Because this was something which over in, I think it was in Singapore years ago, they were telling me that somebody was going around making these t-shirts with don't worry, be happy t-shirts. Well, don't worry, be happy. No, we can do better than that. Because can you really be happy when worry? I said, no, let's go a bit. What is worry anyway? What is anxiety? What is causing you the stress in the future? It's thinking it's all going to go wrong. It's looking at the future with a negative mind. I'm going to fail my exam. I know I'm not going to do well. I'm terrible. I'm going to whatever. Yeah, exactly. I'm glad that somebody laughed at my joke, even though it was delayed quite a bit. But looking at the future with a negative mind. And that is what we call anxiety, fear. But looking at the future with a positive mind is called being hopey. And I mentioned that word, and I wanted to actually get it in the front of a book title, but they said, no, don't put don't worry, be hopey, put don't worry, be grumpy. And where did that one come from? That one came from, is she here? No, she's not here this evening. From this lady who was just so fed up, trying to be happy, it was stressing her out. You get stressed out trying to be happy all the time? Trying to be healthy all the time? I'm not always healthy. I get sick too. But I still recall this time when I went to the doctor's surgery in Byford years ago, and I was sitting in there waiting for my appointment. When? Because I was teaching in jails, in prisons at that time, when one of the prison officers came in and he looked at me and he glared at me. I was just sitting in there waiting for my appointment with the doctor, and he said, this is verbatim, I remember this, he said, I never expected to see you in here, because I'm supposed to be a monk, meditating, living a healthy lifestyle. I'm not supposed to be sick. So I really started to feel really guilty. I should be much better as a monk, eat better food, exercise more, do more meditation, live a less stressful life. So, I felt guilty. Even monks get sick. Even monks have stress. Even monks get sick. Even monks die. But not today. So sometimes when we learn not to be perfect and to be at peace with not being perfect, then the stress disappears. Now this is where we learn about not fighting the world, especially when you come here. Understanding the world. Making peace with the world. Learning, like I was doing when I was meditating beforehand, feeling this irritation in the throat, which wanted to burst out with a cough. Not stopping it, not suppressing it. Suppressing it, I would have coughed much more. Not fighting it, but being a friend, being at peace with it, Because when you're a friend with things, it's amazing just how things start to get very, very peaceful. They settle down. Even feelings in my body, if I fight them, I'm afraid of them, they get worse. And had amazing sort of experiences, not just even personal ones, with other people. Just having all these cancers and sinus cancers and psoriasis, and goodness knows I've seen so much people who just, unfortunately, that the medical profession just can't help them. Run out of all of their possible ways. But finding other ways, and making peace with things, being kind to them, relaxing them. Just like there was one doctor who came to see me on a Friday because she had a patient on a Thursday who had really severe anxiety. And that she was, this person with anxiety was on an oxygen mask because, you know, just to breathe. And this, oh, I didn't actually say about the Ronnie story, but anyway, the grumpy story. But anyway, she was on an oxygen mask, and every type of treatment had been tried, and so, except for Ajahn Brahm's treatment. So she said, anyway, so what the treatment was when you're anxious, when you have a panic attack, understand it, feel it first of all. Where is it? And for her, it was on her chest. And really get to know it. Don't fight it. Don't try and get rid of it. Get to know it. And once you get to know it, that's actually, it's the, not the best title for a book, but, you know, the Chinese Art of War. Know the enemy, know yourself. 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. Just know the sickness, know the problem, know what's going on. Once you get to know it, then we taught her to be kind to it by giving a nice massage on the chest. Nice massage on the chest. To be kind, not to try and get rid of things, but to get to know it and be kind to it. Make peace with it. Be kind to that physical manifestation of anxiety. And she told me afterwards, the next day when she went to check on the ward, that patient had an oxygen mask off and said, "I'm okay now, can I go home?" These things sometimes work. Getting to know, not fighting, making peace with things. I can't say who the doctor is because she might get in big trouble, but she's an excellent doctor. Anyway, this is what happens when you learn about different ways of dealing with stress, stress-related anxiety. How do you overcome that? Fighting it? Trying to get rid of it? That makes more stress. Being kind to it. Being kind. Oh, poor itchy throat. Poor little cough. You're okay. That type of kindness, not trying to make it perfect, but making peace with how things are, is changing your relationship to much of the things which you do in your life. Changing the way you look at your world. Changing the way you look at your partner. Do you really want to try and improve him or her? If you do, it's a lot of stress. You should know that by by now, but being kind to them. Caring, not curing. It's a wonderful way of caring, and people want to do the right thing. They want to be. It's not out of tension and tightness and fear. It's out of something else. I've seen many, many so-called violent, bad people in places like jails. We always see inside of them some very beautiful inner part of them. People, I don't know if I told this story. Did I tell the story of that drug dealer? And I'm not sure, recently. Anyway, see the beauty inside. There was this person over in jail I was looking after and just teaching and trying to get him to be you know, a better person, a meditator. He was a Greek. Okay, his name was Nick, of course. But anyway, this fellow, I was teaching him meditation, and just not meditation, kindness, changing our attitude, being a kinder person rather than a sort of a negative person. But of course, he felt so guilty about what he'd done. And one of the things which changed his life, it's a beautiful story, that I went early one evening to give the meditation class, and he grabbed me by the shoulder and he pulled me to the schoolroom in the prison. And in the schoolroom from the prison, there was all these cards and messages from one of the from these, I think, year six or year sevens. Because what had happened, and I can't really say what this, where this school was, but really amazing. The principal of this school, you know, deserves a medal. She had the courage to actually, when she wanted to try and protect, you know, her children from the drugs, which apparently, this surprises me, where in some schools you can get them when you're grade 6 or grade 7. You know, it's even in that part of our school system, let alone later on we're in high school. And she wanted to do something to try and help or ward these kids away from getting involved in drugs, non-medicinal drugs. And so first of all, get a psychologist, professor, someone from university, someone from maybe the police department. But her brainwave was to get two convicted prisoners, people who had been there, done that, and were suffering because of what they had done. People who really knew what they were talking about and were still suffering the pain of what they had done, to get permission for them to go into this grade 6, grade 7 at school and teach the kids what drugs really do. They spend the whole day in there. And, of course, what happens in many primary schools, the kids the day after in art class made all these little cards and messages for these two prisoners. And when, when Nick dragged me and showed me these messages, "Dear Nick, hope you get out soon. When you do get out, please come and visit us. I'll never do drugs, not after what you told me. Thank you so much for telling us what it's really like. You know, you're so authentic." They never actually said that, but that's what they meant, that we will never do drugs anymore. "Please, please, thank you so much for what you did to us, did for us, telling us about what harm the drugs do." Because these were guys who were feeling that pain every day inside jail. And Nick, he was weeping. Tears were just right down his face. He'd done something useful. Used his pain, his shame, and just his guilt to try and make use of his experience to help a few classes of kids resist the myth of pleasure from drugs. And I remember just seeing him, and actually just, I saw him, like last time I saw him, I don't know where he is now, but I was in the Perth airport some years ago. It's amazing how much time I spend in Perth airport, surprise, surprise. But when I was in Perth airport, I was waiting for another monk to arrive, and this guy put his hand on my shoulder, and I turned around and said, "Hey, do you remember me?" "Yeah, Nick, how are you going?" He's in a very nice seat. He said, "Fine." He said, "I'm doing really well. No more sort of drugs." And he said, and he stood with a big smile, "I'm still meditating every day. Promise, every day I meditate." There's a wonderful little story there, how, instead of feeling guilty, he made use of, you know, his knowledge to make sure that nobody else, and experience to make sure that no one else goes down a path like that. And of course, who could say it better than someone who had been hurt deeply? And I still remember those beautiful tears that sort of principle. You know, good on you. I wish other people had the guts to do that. And just to realize that the best way is authenticity. And yeah, they're not perfect teachers of kids. They're in jail. And they've got a record of drugs. But how they could get a message across so beautifully, so well. So that's one of the reasons why that we don't punish or fight. We learn, we're kind, and that's the way we get healed. Those two prisoners got healed with the kindness they felt from kids. You know, even years ago, prison stories now. Years ago when I was visiting Fremantle Jail, when it was still a real jail with prisoners inside, and one of the old prisoners who'd been in there for 40, 50 years or something, you know what he said? These are things I remember. He said, you know, that look around. All you see is grey walls. You see men. Very rarely even see a female inside a jail. But he said what he really missed was seeing children, kids playing. He wasn't a paedophile or anything, but he just missed seeing young people, kids. And sometimes what that can do to a human being, not to see sort of kids messing around, babies, children, you know, just life was just men. And maybe every now and again a woman, but they were just seeing just such a small part of life. He said that hurt more than anything else of his sentence. So anyway, sometimes we can be so cruel. And kindness, I think, could work much, much better. Anyway, so there's a little talk this evening on how to let go of stress so we can be peaceful and relax to the max. And if you'd have seen how I was coughing my guts out this afternoon going into the car, it's amazing you can give a talk, let alone a talk with hardly, well, maybe a few coughs here and there, but not that many. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so any questions, comments, or complaints? Any complaints you can give to the management? Okay. Any questions from the floor? Or from the cushions, or from the chairs, or from somewhere. Okay, not yet. Here we go. From Poland, I feel safe and joyous at home, but do you have advice how I can avoid feeling stressed outside my home? You can be like the snail who carries the home with them. Now, how can you do that in Poland? You can create this beautiful, like the bubble, which often I do. Whenever I really go to noisy places and I want to have a nice, peaceful meditation, I do imagine a bubble around me. Imagine a bubble, that's my little home. It's my little cave. It's only imagination, but you're peaceful and joyous in there. And so other people, yeah, you know, you can see them through the window, but they're not actually inside with you. So that's your little bubble inside. Yeah, you can let a few people, nice people in there, but that becomes your home, which you can carry around with you. A home of peace and happiness, of where you are welcome. From Wisconsin, my son, who is 17 years old, believes he has attained all his happiness this world has to offer. And he has attempted suicide several times. As a mum, how can I help him? Oh, there's much more happiness than you can even imagine. So, what I would encourage him to do, because he's in the United States, I do travel around, and the next trip to the United States is for the 11th Global Conference on Buddhism in Sennebeck Hall in Berkeley. And it's even this one girl, Sarah, I don't know if she's listening, but, you know, she was, I don't mind saying some of her stories, I think it's actually online, that she was, her father committed suicide, then her mother died a short time later, and then she was just really lost. And then someone said, look at Ajahn Brahm's talks. And so, and she listened to one of my talks, and she said, it's okay. These things happen. Life is not perfect. And what I actually said and how I said it just really got into her. And so she is at peace with what happened to her. Her mum and dad both passing away. And so she has, because she sent a little video to the organisers, she has free tickets to get to this little conference. Actually, I think many people can get free tickets if they want them. But this is how you can learn other ways of happiness. There's more to life than 17 years of age. You haven't scratched the surface of understanding, wisdom, happiness, service to others. So that's in the end of June. From Leesville, Wisconsin, it's not that far. It's in the same continent somewhere. So from there to San Francisco. So, Lisa, send your son over to Wisconsin. From Wisconsin over to Berkeley to the conference on meditation. I'd be very happy to talk to him and show him an even better way of smiling. Very happy to do that. And from Philadelphia, with all the tragedy in the world, especially the acts of violent crime, how can we love unconditionally? Because there is violent crime. Because all the acts of violence. That means we have to love even more unconditionally. Otherwise, if we hate, if we give revenge, it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. It's because we don't love and forgive. Because people aren't kind. Because they expect too much from other people. Because people aren't respected. Because people feel afraid. Because people just overreact. So tight and so tense. Small thing makes them really overreact. Good old Mahatma Gandhi. See many, many thousand reasons to give my life for a cause. Not one reason to take the life of another. Very beautiful. There are heroes in this world. Or that President Sadat of Egypt, who just, you know, when a big war between Israel and Egypt, he decided, no protocol, he just got on a plane and just flew to Tel Aviv and made peace. He sacrificed his life, he was assassinated afterwards. It's worthwhile doing. Wouldn't it be wonderful if Mr. Trump just got on the plane and went to go and see Mr. Kim? Just the two of them. No prior arrangements. Just two people. Yeah, I live in hope. Sometimes people actually do these amazing things which change the world. Anyway, acts of violent crime, how can we love unconditionally? It's because there's so much hate in the world. That's why we have to increase our unconditional love and forgiveness. Otherwise, this world just spirals into more crime and violence and negativity. So anyway, there we go. Any questions from the floor? Okay, oh, there's one. Yeah.
Ajahn Brahm, sometimes my negativity can feel stronger than my kindness. So how to build kindness and work with kindness in everyday life?
The negativity sometimes feels stronger. It gets you quick rewards, long-term problems. Because if you're really negative and you shout at people, then people are afraid of you. And so it seems that they're listening. They're not listening to you, they're listening to fear. It's just like, but with the kindness, it's a totally different sort of arrangement. People actually trust you. And that trust between people. I just mentioned this today, when one of the first times when I was building Bodhinyana Monastery that I don't mind mentioning, it was Colley and Sons. They had a timber yard down Brookton Highway. I went there one day to get some timber to build a kuti or something. It's a lot of timber, I was in a rush. When I got back, I said, oh my goodness, we there's some stuff we hadn't paid for. So I went back on the next day. I said, look, you know, we got some timber from you yesterday, just in a rush, with no intention, we hadn't paid for it. You know, can we sort of pay the difference? And a fellow looked at me as if I was like from Mars or some alien planet somewhere. And he said, just hold on a moment. And he went up to see the big the big manager. And then he said, okay, you can pay for the extra timber, but now you're on a builder's discount. And we're not builders, well, not really professional builders, but you know, he gave us a builder's discount. And just the amount of money, you know, the monastery paid just for that bit of timber, maybe $10 or $15, we made that back 10, 20, 100 times probably by getting the builder's discount from that place. He said, because it's weird. Not many people do that. Not many people are honest and trustworthy. So sometimes that negativity, the trustworthiness, the forgiveness is worth so much in our world. There are good people in this world. Maybe it's because in my life I've looked for good people. And bad people, I just don't believe they're bad. I look for the goodness in the so-called bad people. And they keep showing it to me again and again and again. So, try. Maybe negativity sort of 6 days a week. But have a positive Monday or something. I don't know. Go to work on Monday or Tuesday and decide today is going to be positive day. Does that work? Give it a try anyway. Just try and being overly positive. Restraining the negativity just to see what happens. Make a resolution. Today there'll be no negativity. Give it a try. Who knows? Something might happen. Apparently, I just read in the newspaper, even the Labour government are trying to get rid of negative gearing. So they're getting the message somewhere. Should be positive gearing. I guess it's a silly joke. But that's one of the reasons why when there's no solitude, because I'm with lots of people, I drift not from solitude into citytude. It's very close to solitude. Citytude. Okay, somebody's going to groan. Thank you very much. Maybe that's a sign we've had enough. And one of the monks has to go off to the airport to catch a plane. So now we can bow 3 times to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and I can get some real solitude instead of citytude if I go back to my room.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.